Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Friday the 23rd of August, these are our main stories. Brazil's President Bolsonaro chairs an emergency meeting on the wildfires in the Amazon, which are causing global concern. Russia has launched the world's first floating nuclear power station. Also,
we condemn this decision, and if the situation continues like this, then everyone here will pick up guns.
Protests continue in Indian-administered Kashmir weeks after Delhi took away the area's special status. And in this podcast, we hear from one of the thousands of refugees fleeing the last major rebel enclave in northern Syria. Researchers say a daily pill could drastically reduce the number of heart attacks and strokes. Plus,
it's a movement that has gained speed online and on social media, and you get that sense of, oh, it's getting that reach now where people do understand it and recognise it.
We learn about one of the top themes this year at the world's biggest arts festival. The ongoing raging wildfires in the Amazon, which can be seen from space, have world leaders worried. The French President Emmanuel Macron has called them an international emergency, and he's not the only one. The European Commission spokeswoman, Mina Andreeva, said the crisis should be at the top of the agenda at this weekend's G7 summit.
The Commission is deeply worried. The Amazon is the world's largest rainforest and contains one-tenth of the world's species. That's why we do welcome President Macron's intention to discuss this issue during the G7 meeting. The sense of urgency is indeed warranted.
But the Brazilian President, Jair Bolsonaro, has accused his French counterpart, Mr. Macron, of displaying a colonialist attitude. Mr. Bolsonaro is to chair an emergency cabinet meeting to deal with the crisis, which he admits has been caused partly by farmers clearing parts of the forest. But he's also blaming NGOs. In turn, environmentalists accuse him of encouraging farmers, loggers and miners to destroy the Amazon. I asked Natalia Passarinho from BBC Brazil, what can Mr. Bolsonaro do to end the crisis?
Well, to start with, he could definitely deploy federal troops to help firefighters that are battling the fire in the north and center east of Brazil. The BBC Brazil spoke with a firefighter who's leading operations in the state of Mato Grosso, and he said the situation is extremely difficult because they are not well equipped enough to deal with such an increase. There were 72,000 fires this year in Brazil in total. And what he said is that the firefighters are having to prioritize. They're having to choose which fires to battle, considering how close they are to indigenous reserves and conservation parks.
And how much is the president to blame for the situation the country is in?
Well, Brazil's environmental policies changed very significantly since he took office in January. And since then, the numbers have worsened as well. Well, Bolsonaro has been very clear in saying that the Amazon is open for business. He wants to attract companies, foreign companies and national companies, to expand economic activities in the Amazon. He even said that this would include mining in indigenous lands. And he had defended to legalize properties that are being used for illegal logging and illegal farmers. So what environmentalists are saying is that this discourse and this shift in policy has encouraged illegal activities in the Amazon, because now illegal loggers and farmers might think that they will not be punished.
We've heard how worried environmentalists, as you mentioned, are, and indeed how worried world figures are, like President Macron of France. I mean, could an international response to this work?
It's interesting, I think, to point out that very recently Brazil, as part of Mercosur, has signed a trade deal with the European Union. And this trade deal establishes very clearly that as condition for it to happen, the countries that are part of this deal should accomplish very concrete measures in order to accomplish the Paris Agreement. So, of course, this trade deal might be an instrument for Europe to put pressure on Brazil's government.
Natalia Passarinho of BBC Brazil. A couple of hours before we recorded this podcast, the world's first floating nuclear reactor was launched by Russia on a trip across the Arctic. The vessel is loaded with nuclear fuel and left the Arctic port of Murmansk for a journey of 5,000 kilometres. It's supposed to be a cheaper alternative to building a nuclear power plant in permafrost conditions, but critics call it a Chernobyl on ice. Vitaly Shevchenko from our Russian service told me more.
Well, it's basically a massive barge with two nuclear reactors, and today it's embarking on this epic journey to the far east of the Russian Arctic. If all goes to plan and it goes online off the remote town of Pevek, this ship, the Akademik Lomonosov, it will become the world's northernmost nuclear power plant. The concept itself of floating nuclear power plants isn't that new. The Americans experimented with it in the 1960s. But Russia is hoping that it would provide power to its very remote regions in the north.
Well, as I said, critics are calling it a Chernobyl on ice. What are the risks?
Well, that's what the activists from Greenpeace are saying. They say it's also a nuclear Titanic. And also they're wondering why send a nuclear power plant to a region which is very rich in natural gas. And also Russia says that this ship, this barge, is one of a series and is hoping to mass produce them and start selling them to other countries, which, of course, raises fears. What if it ends up in the hands of a country where the safety record is much worse than Russia's? And even in Russia, we know that earlier this month there was an explosion at a military range in the Arctic which killed five nuclear engineers. So nuclear concerns abound.
Is it much cheaper to do this? I mean, why do it?
Well, in the longer term, what we're seeing is essentially a scramble for the Arctic. The ice, as it melts, it opens up new trade routes, new lucrative trade routes between China and Europe, for example, which Russia is planning to exploit. And also, global warming makes it easier to access the mineral riches.
Vitaly Shevchenko of the BBC's Russian service. Australia is to end a Chinese government-funded language scheme because of fears of political interference. In response, China says ordinary exchange programs should not be politicised. Our Asia-Pacific editor Michael Bristow reports.
New South Wales says it will bring to a close its programme with China's Confucius Institute to teach Chinese to state school pupils. A review found there was no evidence of interference from China, but there was a perception of foreign influence. Confucius Institutes provide language and cultural courses at hundreds of schools and universities across the world, but they have been accused, particularly in the United States, of spreading Chinese government propaganda.
Michael Bristow. Indian-administered Kashmir has been extremely tense for more than 2 weeks after the Indian government terminated the region's semi-autonomous status. This means that Kashmir's special powers to make its own laws and to give jobs to local people have been taken away. The government has deployed thousands of extra troops there and communications have been disrupted. Samir Hashmi sent us this report on the mood among Kashmiris.
Tension is rising in Indian-administered Kashmir. Last week, in the inner quarters of the main city Srinagar, hundreds marched through the narrow alleys shouting slogans against the Indian state. Internet connection and mobile phone services still remain suspended. The Indian government's decision to revoke Kashmir's special privileges has left these people fuming.
We condemn this decision, and if the situation continues like this, then everyone here will pick up guns.
Communication system bhi inhone bitha diya hai bahar.
They have blocked communication channels. We are not able to contact anyone. Even if someone dies here, no one will come to know. They have imprisoned us.
According to varying reports, 2,000 to 4,000 people have been detained ever since the special status was withdrawn. Parveen says her son Aqib was one of them. She says he was picked up by security forces in the middle of the night from their house in South Kashmir.
They knocked on our door at 3:30 a.m. They said, "Open the door or we will break it." They surrounded my son with guns. When they were taking him away, they said they will leave him soon. Since then, I haven't seen my son.
Prominent politicians in the region have also been arrested under a controversial act that allows the government to detain people for up to 2 years without trial.
One political party at the centre is putting all of opposition under lockdown.
Shehla Rashid, a Kashmiri activist, has called these actions undemocratic.
Yes, as a ruling party, they have the right to take decisions. But as opposition, the other parties also have a right to oppose that decision. They are not. That's not being allowed. And that's a direct murder of democracy. That may sound very rhetorical, but that is what is happening. It is a murder of democracy.
There have also been clashes between protesters and security forces. 2 weeks ago, soldiers fired pellet bullets when thousands of people came out to protest in one of the neighborhoods in Srinagar. One man who doesn't want to be identified told the BBC he was shot in the leg during the demonstration.
The security forces targeted my right leg and fired. I fell down and lost a lot of blood.
The government has defended the heavy clampdown in the region. Swapan Das Gupta, a leader of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, says tough action was necessary to prevent violence.
These are exceptional measures. These are not measures that are ordinarily taken recourse to, but these are not ordinary circumstances.
But can you do this in a democracy?
Because you can do it in a democracy sometimes. Look, the idea is not that an entire population should be starved of this, of certain basic communication facilities, that they should be kept isolated and insulated from the rest of the world and the rest of the country. The idea is for a contingency measure.
There is only one solution!
One solution! One solution!
India has had a troubled relationship with Kashmir for decades. The current unrest could become a defining moment. With anger simmering, the tense situation on the ground is unlikely to change anytime soon.
Samir Hashmi reporting from Indian-administered Kashmir. You're listening to Global News, the best stories, interviews and on-the-spot reporting from the BBC World Service. Every weekend you can hear a review of the week's main news stories and why they matter. That's in The World this week, and Jill McGivering joins me now to tell me what's in the latest edition.
This week we're on fire. A new dawn breaks in Sudan after 30 years pro-democracy leaders and generals share power in a slow burn revolution. Italy's short-lived coalition goes up in smoke, but what will rise from the ashes? Hong Kong's leader tries to douse the flames of protest but can't put them out. And in Brazil, day becomes night as the rainforest burns like never before.
Thanks, Jill. That's all in The World this week, broadcast on Saturdays and Sundays and available to download from our website at www.bbc.co.uk/programmes. And still to come in this edition of our own podcast.
It's called Airness. It's just this je ne sais quoi. It's almost impossible to define, but you know it when you see it. It's just the X factor. Airness is oozing out of this guy. It's charisma. It's Airness, baby. It's Airness.
We find out what qualities you need to become a world champion air guitarist. In Syria, President Assad's forces, backed by the Russians, are retaking areas held by rebel groups in Idlib province in the north of the country. The government troops have also surrounded a Turkish military observation post there. Turkey sides with the opposition. The Syrian government says they've created a humanitarian corridor allowing civilians to escape, and hundreds of thousands have already fled further north. Our correspondent Martin Patience has been speaking to people heading to the Turkish border. He spoke to Mazan Shahani, who's a blacksmith and a father of six, including 11-month-old twins.
We have come to a new camp. It has a dusty ground and 25 tents, and there are 3 to 4 families in each tent. There is only one toilet in the camp. We are deprived of the basic necessities of life.
A Mezen told me the family left their home with whatever they could grab.
We barely escaped with our lives. We brought 2 mattresses and 2 blankets as a sleeping kit because we didn't know where we were heading. We don't have many things. There is no health facility, medicine, water, nor a sewage system. Back at home, we didn't let the kids go outside because we worried they would be bombed by the aircraft. When we brought them here, they cried. They didn't want to leave. We told them there are no planes in the place we are going to, and that they can play outside and make new friends.
And this isn't the first time they've been forced to move. Half of Syria's population have fled their homes because of the fighting.
I fled once and will flee multiple times to find a safe place for my kids. But where's the world? Don't they have any humanity? Aren't they seeing what is happening to the Syrian people? We are so tired. How long can we keep on fleeing?
Syrian refugee Mazen Shahani speaking to Martin Patience. I asked our Middle East analyst Alan Johnston about the latest reported successes by the Syrian government forces.
Well, for years, rebels and civilians fleeing the Syrian government have been gathering in this northwestern province of Idlib. It's become the last major opposition bastion. The major group fighting there is a jihadi organisation that used to be linked to al-Qaeda. The government says it wants to take all this territory back. And in the last week or more, we've seen government forces backed by the Russians making serious advances in southern Idlib, capturing towns and villages that have been in rebel hands for years. Earlier in the week, the militants were driven out of the town of Khan Sheikhoun, which lies on a key highway. So we are seeing a sense of real momentum behind the government drive in this battle for southern Idlib now.
Any solution in sight for civilians?
If the government is making progress, then it is coming at an appalling cost for civilians. Russian and Syrian government warplanes have been pounding away at rebel-held towns behind the lines. The UN says that something like 500,000 civilians have been forced to flee. Hundreds have been killed, and there really is no immediate hope of respite from the civilians from any quarter that I can see.
Alan Johnston, our Middle East analyst. A pill made from four common drugs has been found to significantly reduce the risk of heart attacks, strokes and sudden death in people over 50. The poly pill contains drugs that lower cholesterol and blood pressure. Shamek Khalil found out more from James DeLemos, a professor of medicine at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School.
What they found were 40 to 50% lower rates of bad outcomes from a heart standpoint, which is a remarkable finding in that it takes what has been shown before, which is that these drugs, when given like this in a poly pill, can maybe lower blood pressure and lower cholesterol to the next step, which is to actually change outcomes for these individuals.
So prevent heart attacks, for example.
Exactly. And they did it in the environment in which the drug makes the most sense, which I think is particularly important. They did it in the community in an area where one could argue that access to these medications is not what it is in the UK and the United States, for example.
And can you just tell our listeners, when we say poly pill, it's a pill that contains different medicines. What are they and normally what do they treat?
Well, the medicines in this poly pill included two blood pressure medications that are commonly used, an ACE inhibitor and a low dose of a diuretic, aspirin, and a cholesterol medication called a statin. And the statin is used to lower blood cholesterol, and then you have the blood pressure medications and the aspirin. And they all are medications that individually have been shown to be beneficial in terms of preventing heart attacks and strokes, but you have to go to the doctor to get these. You have to be monitored. And most individuals who are at risk don't take them. And the concept of the poly pill is that you sort of democratize prevention. You forget about going to the doctor. You take these medications and without checking to see if people need them, you administer very low doses of them broadly so that you lower the levels of the risk factors in everybody.
Professor James DeLemos of the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. Now to the city of Edinburgh in Scotland, which is hosting the world's largest arts festival. It lasts almost a month and there are nearly 4,000 shows at this year's Fringe Festival, everything from political satire to jazz to reinventions of the circus Big Top. But one new theme has emerged in the past couple of years, body image. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd went to Edinburgh to find out why.
Beachbody Ready opens with a bounce with Shamir's On the Regular. The show is equally brash and audiences in Edinburgh love it.
Hi, I'm Sarah and this
I'm 5'3", a size 22. I've got really long eyelashes and I've got pretty banging
eyes. Of the cast of three, two identify as fat. The other is normal size, but normality in body shape is a concept up for grabs. Lizzie Perry of the Roaring Girls Theatre Company.
The Roaring Girls make theatre that is fierce, feminist and fun. The origin of the show was when the two fat performers, they're perfectly comfortable being called fat. I myself am also fat. The three of us got stuck in the back of a Ford Fiesta and we actually started laughing and chatting about our bodies. We'd never spoken about our experiences as fat women, ever. Obviously, body positivity has grown out of sort of fat acceptance and fat liberation, but it's a movement that has gained speed online and on social media, and you get that sense of, oh, it's getting that reach now where people do understand it and recognise it. And I think that's one of the reasons why there is so many shows that are talking about bodies this year, is that it's reaching the sort of a national conversation rather than being a fringe conversation.
Freeze! Everybody clap your hands!
Take your seat for Fatty Fat Fat, and the performer is already doing her cha-cha slide, challenging the perception that only the slender look good at the gym.
Okay, straight through to question number one. How many pencils can I fit under my left breast? Now, do we think it's higher or lower than five?
Hi, my name is Katie Greenall. I'm up in Edinburgh with my debut autobiographical solo show, Fatty Fat Fat, about what it's like to navigate the world in a fat body, my experiences, and commenting on the wider fat acceptance movement in amongst all of that personal experience as well. And that's intersected by kind of more interactive moments where I kind of provoke the audience to think more about the wider fat acceptance, fat activist movement, and also further intersected by some more poetic moments reflecting on where I'm at with that process now. People like look like me in this world. People really do navigate the world in fat bodies, whether or not they use that term or not.
Niamh Callan is half the cast of Tea with Milk, which looks at the pressure advertising and social media put on young women. Like almost all performers I spoke to in Edinburgh, Niamh mentioned the growing influence of Facetune.
It's an app where you can get rid of, like, if you've got dark circles under your eyes, you can change them, you can hide your double chin, you can increase your smile, you can change the shape of your body to make it thinner if you'd like to, or bigger if that's what you're going for. Young girls are seeing a lot of it and thinking that they need to look like that. And I know, like, my little cousins are all saying that they have, like, an unrealistic body standard.
The Fringe doesn't have a curator inviting on-trend shows to Edinburgh, but the performers are mainly under 30, and questions of body image increasingly are part of their world.
This is me on a regular singing note.
That report from the Edinburgh Festival by Vincent Dowd. As my colleague said, a fine figure of a man. Now, confession time. Have you ever played air guitar, as in thrashed your arms around pretending to play an imaginary guitar while you're rocking out to a favourite track? Some of the best air guitarists in the world are gathering in Oulu in Finland for the Air Guitar World Championships. Ben James found out more from someone who's won the title a couple of times, Matt Burns, otherwise known as the Aristotle.
It's literally the act of pretending to play the guitar to find out who is the deadliest on the planet with a fictional instrument. These competitions are going on all over the world. It's a lot like lip syncing.
How do you build up the routine? Is it spontaneous on the day, or is there lots of rehearsal involved?
There's a lot of rehearsal. There are two rounds and a contest. The first round, you have to come with your own song, your own choreography, your own routine, have your own moves all set. The top scores go to the second round. You don't know what song you're going to get. It's a compulsory track. And that's when you separate who are the real rock gods from the people who are just pretending to play the guitar.
So you're stepping up there, hearing that track for the very first time.
Yep. The crowd hears it with the competitors for the first time. So it's really what separates the best from the rest at that point.
The judges mark you, like in the Olympics, I guess. What are they looking for?
There are five judges. And they're giving you a score 4.0 to 6.0. And they're looking for three things. They're looking for technical merit. Does it look like you're playing the guitar to the song that we're hearing? Stage presence, which is your character, your costume, the show overall that you're putting on. Is the crowd responding to it? Are they booing if you want them to boo? Some people like to be bad guys up on stage. And finally, it's the most important by far. It's called airness. It's just the je ne sais quoi. It's almost impossible to define, but you know it when you see it. It's just the X factor. Airness is oozing out of this guy. It's charisma. It's airness, baby. It's airness.
So for anyone listening who wants to do this to your level, what would you advise them to do to persuade the judges to be able to win a world title?
The first thing that I would tell them to do is just get ready to have a good time. If you come in this with a super serious mindset, I think it's going to work against you. This is a fun night. All the competitors, the judges, the host, and the crowd are there to have a good time. So remember to have fun is very, very important. I would say stretching is never a bad idea. You know, if you're going to be a rock god, you might be squeezing into some spandex. And when the adrenaline hits, because the crowd's going crazy, you might try to do a jump. And finally, I would definitely recommend have a couple more beers than you've been having lately. This all just makes way more sense if you're a little drunk.
Matt Burns, who's twice won the Air Guitar World Championships, speaking there to Ben James. And if you feel like practicing a bit of air guitar yourself, here's Matt's favourite track, Party Hard by Andrew WK. Party Hard by Andrew WK. And it's time now for News from Elsewhere, our weekly look at some less reported stories from around the world. With me in the studio is Crassie Twigg from the BBC monitoring team. And one of your stories, Crassie, is about a controversy at the Varna Dolphinarium in Bulgaria. Tell us about it.
Yes, well, earlier in the month, a baby dolphin died at the Dolphinarium in Varna. And what was particularly distressing was reports that it died during a live performance, something the Dolphinarium categorically denied. A few days after this incident, though, there was another revelation that added fuel to the fire. It was reported that a group of MPs had introduced a change to the bill about protection of animals, and that change would make it legal to include the two lion seals at the attraction in the live performances. That prompted a lot more anger on social media, and a petition was circulated to close the venue.
A lot of people will be surprised to hear this, because the prevailing trend these days is towards the closure of such places, isn't it? Particularly in Europe.
Yes, it is. Many European countries don't have such parks and there are strict regulations. The UK, for example, closed them more than 25 years ago after a high-profile animal rights campaign. But there are countries, Bulgaria, Spain, Italy, Romania, that seem to be swimming against the tide. Because it is now widely accepted among experts that captivity is harmful to these animals because they're highly intelligent, they're capable of emotions, they're socially complex and need vast space. And it's not just Europe. Many societies around the world are rejecting the idea of captivity of dolphins and whales.
And now to Iran, where people have taken to Twitter, haven't they, to vent about women's rights. What's triggered it this time?
A bike-sharing company in the capital, Tehran, has come under fire for not allowing women to register on their mobile app. Why? Well, the company hasn't said a word, but there's speculation that it's come under pressure from authorities to do so. Now, some users say they're going to block the company altogether. One man has tweeted, "As long as women are banned, men have no reason to use it."
And women are banned, are they, from riding bicycles?
Well, not officially, but hardline clerics are seeing this as provocative and therefore against Sharia law. And there are plenty of other examples of Iranian authorities trying to enforce non-existing laws. Famously, women are not allowed in football stadiums, for example, to watch men's games, even though there's no official ban. And whenever women have in the past managed to gain entry by disguising themselves as men, they have been arrested. So, by the way, this has been also a topic of conversation on Twitter this week, because the football season started yesterday in Iran. And until the last moment, there was uncertainty whether women will be allowed in. The government has been under pressure by FIFA, the world's football governing body, to let women attend. So today, sports officials confirmed that women will be allowed to watch men's national football games, but not club football games yet. And so these kind of stories tend to provoke a lot of heated response on social media, where particularly the young generation has shown to be increasingly aware and vocal about women's rights.
And finally, this made me smile, although some people in Wellington in New Zealand might not find it funny. Crassie, a giant hand statue has been erected on top of the City Gallery. Tell us about it.
Yes, it's one of those stories you have got to see the picture to appreciate it. It's 5 meter tall hand with a face on it that weighs half a ton. So that's been positioned on top of the Wellington City Gallery to the horror of some residents. One woman said it left her feel deeply uncomfortable and perplexed. But this is a piece of art. Perhaps this was the point of it, to shock and provoke. And the curator of Wellington City Gallery says it's about how things that seem different tend to be misunderstood.
Crassie, thank you. Crassie Twigg there from the BBC's monitoring team, bringing us this week's news from elsewhere. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.